consultant comes in, all hell breaks loose. I swear, in a couple of hours, my breasts went from soft and full to the size and firmness of a regulation NFL football. I think that the only reason my baby wasn't petrified by these breasts, which were far bigger than his head, was that he was so hungry. That was when I first realized how much I was going to love my nursing bra. I wore one day and night for months because sleeping with breasts that are full of milk can be uncomfortable. Legend has it that French women go to bed wearing sleeping bras in the belief that breasts deserve to be supported at all times. Now that I have seen how hard a woman's breasts have to work, I think that they not only deserve a pretty bra, but a paid vacation for two to the Caribbean. While we are on the subject of nursing bras, you should also bring nursing breast pads, which are disposable, absorbent circles that catch minor leaks. You slip them into your bra between your nipple and the nursing flap of the bra. They keep your bra clean longer, and the last thing you will be needing when you get home from the hospital is extra laundry. You might also want to check out a newer contraption called a breast shield. These are cups made out of latex or plastic, and they fit right over your nipples. They not only catch more leakage than the pads, but they keep your bra from chafing against your chewed-on nipples by creating an airspace around them. Bring a book on nursing. Getting a baby to drink from your breast can be more difficult than learning to use a Cuisinart. I know that is the most natural act in the world, but I have seen women sobbing over their failure to get the baby to latch on properly to the nipple so that the milk comes out. Here's the news flash for novices. The milk just does not come out of a hole at the tip of your nipple, as I had always imagined. It comes out of several little holes all over the nipple, and it only comes out when the baby has it in a vice-like grip, with the entire brown part of your breast against the roof of its mouth. Before you panic, let me assure you that almost every hospital will have someone on staff who can teach you to nurse your baby. Some people are so qualified at it that they are called lactation specialists. This is also where a good book with illustrations can be handy. While your baby is resting and you are still relatively calm, you can study the book. Then when the baby wakes up crying and hungry, perhaps you will have a faint idea of what you are supposed to do. Trust me, if you don't seem to have the technique perfected immediately, some nurse is guaranteed to grab your breast in one hand and the baby's head in the other and manipulate them until she gets both to do what she wants. Your job is to sit there as quietly as possible and watch yourself being manhandled by a total stranger. Bring a camera and film. This is going to be the most incredible experience of your entire existence, and you must commemorate it with lots of pictures. For the rest of your life, you will love sentimentally going over the pictures of the day your baby was born. Nowadays, video cameras are even more popular at birthing parties than still cameras. And we all know people who cherish their videotape recollections of every single detail of the baby's birth. My best advice is that you resist the urge to upload to YouTube. My other personal rule is that no camera, still, or video is allowed below my waist, but that's because I don't trust those guys who work in the one-hour photo labs. What if you get famous someday and one of those guys has held on to a few of your negatives? Or worse, what if your six-year-old finds the DVD and mistakes it for his Lion King disc? Remember, labor and delivery almost always last far longer than you will plan for or can imagine. Therefore, unless you carefully plan ahead, your partner could find himself out of film or with a dead battery just as the baby is coming down the pike. If he is videotaping the event, suggest that he try to save the battery by using the AC plug or, to be on the safe side, by having two or three batteries charged for this occasion. Many medical people seem to have a touch of the artist, and they are often quite willing to take pictures for you if your husband feels too faint or if he wants to hold his new baby. My son's pediatrician was a terrific photographer. He not only shot pictures during the birth, but he followed the baby into the nursery and then out to meet the grandparents, clicking all the while. Being dressed in doctor scrubs worked rather like a press pass. He went anywhere and shot anything he wanted without anyone kicking him out. Bring your telephone list. As you can well imagine, several people are going to want to know when the baby is born. In fact, I can think of a few who will not speak to you or have Thanksgiving dinner with you if you fail to call them as soon as the little tyke has been whisked off to the nursery. Chances are, the job of telecommunicating will fall to your husband, since you will either be too tired or too blissed out to handle something as complicated as a phone. But your partner, too, has just had his universe changed, and he may only remember to call the person he was supposed to meet for breakfast the next morning, or might even be unable to recall anyone's phone number. Your job in the boring days before your labor begins is to put together a call list with names and numbers ranked in order of importance. For example, first on the list should be your parents, since you are the mother here, then his parents, then grandparents, best friends, and neighbors. If you haven't already called them when you are in labor, your husband may tire of this chore and not finish the list, but if the calls are ranked, he will have at least hit the most critical ones before falling asleep in the leatherette chair beside your hospital bed or going off in search of food. One last thing about telephoning people with the news that you two have become parents. If the birth has occurred in the middle of the night or after 10 p.m. or before 8 a.m., the only people who will want to hear from you immediately will be your parents, siblings, and friends who have kids of their own. Friends who have never personally experienced this miracle will only see this call as an interruption of their slumber and would prefer hearing your glorious news after they've had some coffee. Bring a girlfriend. Even though she won't fit into a small overnight bag, do seriously consider bringing a girlfriend to the hospital with you when you go in to have your baby. Any warm, loving girlfriend will do, but she would be particularly spectacular if she herself had at some time given birth. As I've been saying since I started this book, having babies is women's work, and having other women around to reassure you, gossip with you, and encourage you is invaluable. If you are really, really lucky, you might have a girlfriend like Amy, who massaged my feet whenever I had a contraction. I will never forget her calm and tireless presence. Perhaps you are thinking to yourself that labor and delivery are a private time for only a husband and wife to share. You worry that you will break the mystical spell by having anyone other than the co-creator of this baby in the room with you. Newsflash! First, your room will be anything but private, even if you have a so-called private room. Before your obstetrician arrives, you will probably have several complete strangers with their hands up inside you. The anesthesiologist will come and go, a nurse or two will be there, and at the end of their shift, they will be replaced by other nurses. Second, labor goes on and on and on, wearing out even the most dedicated partner. About 5 hours into it, your guy will probably be down the hall chatting with his newfound friends in the waiting room, and you will be watching Survivor in between your contractions. Rather than rage at your mate for tiring of this tedium and mentioning for the third time that he is hungry, give the guy a break and have a girlfriend come and sit with you. If you want to preserve a sacred moment, clear everyone but your partner, who is probably having a donut and coffee at this point, out of the room when your doctor tells you it is time to push. Then the two of you can share becoming the three of you. What to bring for the baby? Isn't that a mind bender? Packing things for a person you haven't even yet met. Not that the baby is left naked until you bring it something to wear from home. The hospital will immediately dress him or her in a t-shirt and a diaper, wrap him or her up really snug in a hospital-issue receiving blanket, which I stole and put in my baby's keepsake boxes. For some sentimental reason that I can't exactly recall right now. And sometimes stick a knit stocking cap on that tiny little head to keep him or her toasty warm. You must have a car seat. The only thing that you absolutely, positively, no negotiating must bring to the hospital for taking the baby home is a proper car seat. In fact, hospitals in most states are prohibited by law from letting a baby be discharged until they have been assured that it will be put in a car seat that meets safety regulations, and that the parents know how to use it properly. A million car seats are on the market, and they range in price from about $40 to over $100. Some of them are designed to accommodate baby sizes from newborn to toddler through the adjustment of the harness straps and the way the seat is buckled into your seat belts. Really spend some time on this, because a good car seat can be your darling baby's barrier against all the things we are too frightened even to imagine. Ask your girlfriends, read consumer reports, and browse through the stores until you find one that you are happy with. Many of my girlfriends ended up buying two car seats for their baby. The first one, which was useful for about 6 months, was the bucket-shaped model intended only for newborns. This shape is appropriate because newborns have no spine or neck control and are comfortable in a sort of curled-up position. You will be astonished at how tiny your new baby will look in a car seat of any kind. And if you buy one of those big ones right now, you will feel obliged to sit beside the baby in the back seat and steady its wobbly head with your hands. Remember, the big difference in car seats for newborns and car seats for older babies is this. Newborn babies' car seats face backward in the car. This is because studies have shown that this puts them at less risk for whiplash and a sudden stop. We girlfriends all opted for the infant car seats that look like plastic buckets, and that latch onto a base that remains buckled into a seatbelt of the car. The bucket part where the baby nestles can be released from the base and carried out of the car by a handle, so you don't have to wake the baby up to get it out of the car. This way it doubles as a baby seat for use inside the house. Some of these seats also have sunshades. Get one of those if you can, because you will spend the next several months worrying about the sun beating down on your baby's face, both for fear of sunburn and because it makes them so cranky. Consider buying a brand new car seat as opposed to borrowing one that your girlfriend's child has outgrown, because there are often safety improvements with each newer model. In fact, some of the really old models of 7 to 10 years ago might not even meet current safety requirements. I want to say one last thing about car seats. Then I want to go on to the fun stuff. Recent studies have shown that thousands of otherwise intelligent parents are using or installing the seats incorrectly. Read the manual. If it says that the seatbelt has to be cinched with the enclosed metal clip, don't throw the metal clip away. Use it. If it says that the seatbelt has to be inserted through a series of tunnels underneath the car seat, then go through every single one, not just the big one in the middle. Also, don't assume that all car seats work alike. You have to read the manual every time you get a new one. I know it can be irritating to figure out those silly diagrams, but keep reminding yourself that a baby is at stake. So, for once in your life, read the instructions. And then, when you are sure you know how the thing works, practice installing it and releasing it several times. Take advantage of your relatively calm state of mind before the baby comes to master this technology. The going home outfit continued. Picking this outfit is so much fun. The only warnings I have are to pick something that doesn't have too many buttons or need to be pulled up over the baby's head, because dressing your newborn for the first time is traumatic for you, not the baby. And select clothing that has legs instead of a gown, because the seatbelt needs to latch between the baby's legs. A t-shirt. Working from the inside out, the first essential is a t-shirt. This shirt should already have been laundered at home, as should all baby clothes, at least for the first 3 months, with one of the mild baby detergents, like Dreft or Ivory Snow, sold in any grocery store. Some infant t-shirts pull over the baby's head, but for a new mother, the shirts that tie or snap closed on the side like a kimono are far less frightening. For the first few days, pulling anything over your new baby's head will convince you that you are at risk of suffocating it or breaking its neck. Since logic will have little effect on you at this point, I won't bother to reassure you about how resilient your baby is. Instead, I suggest clothing that will allow you to avoid the situation entirely. In your shopping excursions for the baby's layette, you will encounter t-shirts that pull over the baby's head and snap between its legs. These articles are traditionally called onesies. We girlfriends think they are great, but not for the brand new baby. First of all, they involve that neck-breaking suffocation thing. Second, they make it difficult to get to the baby's belly button, to clean it with alcohol until the umbilical stump falls off. And third, the crotch snaps hold the shirt against the belly button, which can't be too comfortable while there is still a stump there. The diaper. The next article in the newborn's uniform is a diaper. I have absolutely no opinion whatsoever about whether you should choose cloth or disposable diapers. Living in Southern California, I can't decide whether it is worse to add to the landfills with disposables or to contribute to the drought and to the chemicals in our water supply by machine washing cloth ones. All I can really tell you about diapers is to change them regularly and to fold down the tops to allow that healing belly button to stay dry and free of chafing. Footsies. You should put something on the baby's feet. For the first couple of days of life, these little creatures have a hard time regulating their body temperature, and their heads, hands, and feet need to be kept cozy. You can either dress the baby in pajamas with the feet sewn in, or you can put on little stretch booties that are sold in all baby stores and drugstores. Whatever you do, don't plan to put shoes on your newborn. I know these little doll shoes look cute in the store displays, but a real baby's feet are so tiny and rounded that the shoes are irritating to them. Besides, it's nearly impossible to put anything other than a sock on an infant's kicking foot, and even socks won't stay on for long. The stylish part. What you choose to put over the core baby uniform is subject to your own taste and sense of humor, since baby clothes can be funny. You should, however, know that the vast majority of new babies sleep almost constantly for the first few days. For that reason, it makes sense to dress them in soft pajamas or rompers rather than miniature sailor suits or tiny dresses. It is also helpful to know that the current wisdom has babies sleeping on their sides or backs, so you might choose clothes that button or snap up the front, or on the shoulder rather than up the back, where the baby would have to lie on them. And stay away from frills, buttons, and bows for now. To cap or not to cap? Until a couple of decades ago, it was unheard of to take a child outdoors without a hat or bonnet on. A capless baby was viewed by all the other mothers as a sorely neglected child who was certain to catch a cold. My mother-in-law, who lives in New York, would silently pray to St. Jude when she'd see me take her Carolina grandchildren out bareheaded. I know that if she had been my mother and not my mother-in-law, she would have threatened to report me to the child welfare offices. But since she didn't want to interfere, she surreptitiously shielded the baby and put her hands over its head when she thought I was not looking. She was right. I must admit that babies do lose a lot of heat from their heads, so if a chill is in the air, a hat is a good idea. Besides, I love my mother-in-law, so if her cap makes her happy, then why not? At least when she is around to see. You don't have to go out and buy tiny caps for your newborn, which can be hard to find small enough or be too expensive, because most hospitals supply a great little knit hat that looks like a longshoreman's cap. Even more preciously, they come in pink for girls and blue for boys. So they eliminate the tedium of constantly having strangers ask your baby's sex. There is no reason, however, to be overly protective and dress the baby like an Eskimo, unless, of course, your baby is an Eskimo. A pacifier. Regardless of your preconceived opinions about binkies, do yourself a favor and buy a couple. Your hospital may provide them, but don't take it for granted. You may thank me for this advice when your husband is driving you home from the hospital. You are sitting in the back seat next to the baby, and the baby starts to wail inconsolably. All new parents start to perspire and experience shallow breathing at a time like this. You don't know whether you are supposed to speed up and get home as fast as you can, pull over to the side of the road and take the baby out of the car to feed it, or in desperation, take the baby out of the car seat and hold it in your lap for the rest of the ride. Whatever you do, do not drive 1 inch with the baby out of its car seat. Not only is it incredibly dangerous, but it is also illegal. An important rule for parents is not to let momentary desperation make you do stupid things. Otherwise, you'll be facing an entire future of doing stupid things. Here is what you do. Put a pacifier in its mouth and gently tap its end until the baby comes down enough to suck on it. If you have nightmares about your 6-year-old going to school with the pacifier, you can add it to the ever-growing list of things to worry about later. A blanket. You will want to wrap the baby in a blanket, even if the weather is mild. This is because being wrapped up nice and tight lets the baby relax and feel protected. When its arms and legs are moving around too freely, the baby feels as if it were falling and its reflex is to jerk to attention. Even in a car seat, you can tuck the blanket around the baby, especially over its hands and feet. An ERP cloth. My girlfriend Sandra invented the fetching title ERP cloths for the diapers or blankets that mothers wear over their shoulders when they are burping their babies. Not only do they serve the obvious function of protecting your clothing from spit up, but they also protect the baby's face from any irritating fabrics or detergent residues in your clothes. You will also constantly use them to wipe drool or some other baby froth from the little one's face. These ERP cloths get better with laundering, since most cloth diapers start out a little stiff when you buy them. Even better than a diaper, in the girlfriend's estimation, is the Carter's Waffle Weave blanket that is sold in most baby stores. It is such an inexpensive blanket that you can buy several. I use them to wrap the baby in, to clean the baby's nose on, to lay over the car seat, and to put over my shoulder. They became such a familiar part of my wardrobe that I frequently left the house wearing one and not noticing. It was quite the fashion statement, especially if it was soiled. The neck donut. A couple of years ago, I noticed a new product in one of the zillions of baby catalogs I receive. It was a small U-shaped ring made of cotton fabric and stuffed with batting. Its purpose was to support the sleeping infant's head in a car seat, baby swing, or infant carrier. I wasn't sure at first whether this was a brilliant invention or just another useless gimmick to sell to naive mothers-to-be. After using it with two of my children, however, I have decided that it is, indeed, a stroke of genius. An infant's neck is so weak, and its head is so heavy, that a baby sleeping in a car looks about to tumble forward at any moment. The neck donut gives the heavy head a place to rest and makes a new mother worry a little less about whiplash. As we all know, one less thing to worry about is a gift from God. Just take care to place it safely away from your baby's face so that it can't ever interfere with breathing. You may be tempted to bring or buy so much stuff, but avoid that urge. We moms-to-be know that our babies deserve everything under the sun. The truth is, however, that they need little more than us. Amazing, isn't it? Chapter 15. Labor Begins. Finally. Among pregnant women, two concerns about labor are universal. Will it hurt? And how will you know when it is happening? The answer to the first concern is, yes, it will hurt, but probably not too badly for the first few hours. Of more immediate importance is how to tell if you are about to go into labor, or if you are, indeed, already there. My girlfriends and I have amassed as many indications as we could think of that your baby is coming soon, and here they are. The nesting instinct. A couple of days before you go into labor, you may feel an irresistible urge to clean your house, or defrost your refrigerator, or put all your CDs in alphabetical order, or some other such anal task. I'm not talking about the normal panicky cleaning fits that some of us fall into when our mother calls and says she is stopping by unexpectedly, or the way you finally get around to putting the broken toilet paper dispenser back on the wall because your brother and his new wife are coming to stay for the weekend. No, I'm talking about the kind of feverish cleaning where you use your husband's toothbrush to scour the pipe that goes from the back of your toilet into the wall. I'm talking about taking off every switch plate in the house and soaking them all in Pine Sol. This is the time when otherwise rational women truly believe that they cannot sleep one more night in a house where the baseboards have not freshly been painted. This is nature's way of making sure that you will be ready for the new baby, and it is called nesting. A week after her due date, my girlfriend Mindy was discovered by her mother, tottering at the top of a 6-foot ladder, feverishly sponging down the shelves at the top of her closets. To indicate how out of character this was, I have to tell you that Mindy's baby is now 7 years old, 19 as of this second edition, and that those shelves have never seen a sponge since. Mindy's alarmed mother tried speaking soothingly to her, much as one would talk to a person standing on a skyscraper ledge threatening to jump. "Are you sure it's such a good idea, dear?" she asked. "Why don't you come down and let me do that for you?" But Mindy was powerless to stop and completely unable to see how bizarrely she was behaving. My girlfriend Sandra started cooking as she neared her delivery date. She calmly and rationally explained that she just wanted to have a few meals frozen so that her husband could microwave them when she was in the hospital and when she first got home. It made sense until I saw Sandra's car in the grocery store parking lot at 7 a.m., waiting for it to open. She made so many casseroles that she filled her own freezer and soon spread out to her girlfriends across the street. When she tired of casseroles, she decided it was imperative to provide some variety for her lucky husband. So she taught herself the intricacies of Chinese cooking in the pre-dawn hours before the grocery store opened. Then she moved on to barbecuing everything she could get her hands on, even if it meant standing outside in the rain, holding an umbrella over the gas grill. Let me cut to the chase. Sandra went into labor, went to the hospital, gave birth, and came home before her husband had time to eat one single lasagna. And she celebrated the birth of her daughter by making Belgian waffles for her parents and in-laws only 6 hours after the baby was born. Okay, so maybe Sandra's not such a good example. One morning at dawn, near the end of her pregnancy, my girlfriend Shirley's husband woke to find her side of the bed empty. Convinced that she was in labor or giving birth in some other room in the house, he leapt naked from the bed to find her. She didn't answer his calls, and he couldn't find her anywhere in the house, even though her car was still in the garage. Then he looked down the steep hill that many people in Los Angeles referred to as their backyard. There was Shirley, pushing and pulling a wheelbarrow filled with fertilizer up and down the hill. Her baby was going to come home to a house with grass, by God. And she had been working toward that end for hours before the sun came up. No mere gardener could be trusted with fertilizing her baby's lawn. No, it was mother's work. Windowsills and shutters became my obsession during one pregnancy. I was determined to eliminate all dust from all rooms, and I bought several contraptions to brush it up, wipe it off, or filter it out of the air completely. One night, I woke feeling as if I had been electrocuted, and I had the sudden realization that all the dust I had brushed off the seals and shutters must have landed in the carpet. My husband had to physically restrain me from ripping up all the carpet in the house. I had to be satisfied with having it professionally cleaned, twice. My girlfriend Jillian, who expresses her nesting instinct in ways more artistic than antiseptic, and who has a cleaning lady to help with the more mundane scrubbing matters, started frantically putting all her loose photos and albums, and desperately trying to bring up to date the baby books of the two children she already had when she was waiting to deliver her third. By the way, this baby book thing can be a real burden, especially after the first baby. Pretty soon the book becomes little more than a storage folder for all the clippings and doctor's reports and report cards that you can jam in it. Everything out of order and unattached. Take it from me. All mothers have deep-seated guilt about unfinished baby books. And if they don't, they have way too much time on their hands. Or, more likely, no baby books. Anyway, getting back to Jillian. There she was on the floor, surrounded by photographs and albums, with a pregnancy the size of a world globe on her lap, trying to make some organization out of this memory chaos. Her understanding, or fearful, husband passed by several times, but dared not suggest that maybe a nap would be more beneficial. No, Jillian had a mission, and would glue gun anyone who thwarted her. Wouldn't you know, she slipped the very last photo into the very last album, then heard a little pop. Her water had broken. Right on cue. General pissed offness. Another indication that you are rounding the home stretch may be a persistent and increased crankiness. I know. Pregnant women are accused of being emotionally unpredictable frequently during the entire 9-10 months of their pregnancies. But there are a lot of good reasons why you should be particularly cranky at this point. 1. You're not sleeping much or well. 2. You are bored with being a biology experiment. And 3. You feel oppressively aware that there is no backing out of this delivery thing now, and you are beginning to suspect that the baby is much easier to deal with while it is inside you than it will be when it is on the outside. But my girlfriends and I think there is something even more unique about these last few weeks of crankiness, something that, to the experienced eye, indicates that this woman is about to erupt. Think of her as a volcano. She's a big old mountain of a thing, but from the outside you can't tell if she is dormant or filled with seething lava. Only a thin trickle of steam indicates that she is about to blow. I remember seeing my girlfriend Maria at a children's birthday party right before the birth of her son. When I went up to say hello, she looked as if she couldn't quite place me, even though we had been friends for 10 years. To the casual observer, she might have looked calm to the point of being nearly unconscious, but to the other mothers in the crowd, she was clearly going to have that baby within hours. Her intuition was telling her that she was to undergo the greatest challenge and transformation of her life, and she seemed to be hunkering down in preparation. As they face the biggest task of their lives, many women begin a subtle kind of withdrawal from their everyday life. They develop what I call the stranger in a strange land syndrome, where they can go through the motions of their usual business, but feel distanced from and uninvolved in it. Things that they would normally find amusing become trivial or irritating. They're sick and tired of being pregnant. They want to get the ordeal of birth going so that they can stop dreading it once and for all. This is a good time for friends and family, especially husbands, to stay out of the pregnant woman's way as much as possible and to answer yes to anything she asks, because any confrontation now is bound to be messy. She has entered the zone. My girlfriend Julie, who is a manicurist and the brightest, cheeriest pregnant person you have ever seen, every week I would try to pry one single complaint out of her, and every week I was disappointed. To her, nausea was a minor inconvenience. Heartburn was something to be endured with good humor, and she didn't know what hemorrhoids were. Then came her last 3 weeks. Overnight, the old Julie has been snatched away, and in her place was a woman who spent the day with her head down, looking at the hand in front of her. She filed and painted those nails with such fervor that you would think she believed each stroke was bringing her much closer to the end of her pregnancy. She had begun the long march, and she was prepared to deck anyone who stood between her and her destination. All of the gossip and chatter that flew around her in the manicure salon just sailed right by her. She didn't seem to hear any of it, and if she did, it must have seemed completely meaningless and trivial, given what she was facing. The baby drops. That certainly sounds dangerous, doesn't it? But the change is subtle and often barely noticeable. At the end of your pregnancy, you might notice the baby is sitting lower in your stomach than before. This is because it's starting to lock into the birth position and is being held in place by your uterus. This generally only happens with your first baby, because in subsequent pregnancies, your weakened stomach muscles drop the baby the minute it gets heavy. Dropping is also referred to by some as lightening, for reasons that I will never understand, because absolutely nothing is getting lighter at this point. Like so many things in pregnancy, dropping is a good news / bad news proposition. The good news is that you will find it easier to take a deep breath and fill out your traumatized lungs. The bad news is that for your lungs to be liberated, your stomach and bladder have to be sacrificed. From now on, you will get full long before you finish a serving of food. You will also constantly feel as if you are about to wet your pants. But when you sit down to relieve yourself, only a teaspoon or two will come out. Diarrhea. Some of my girlfriends have told me that their tummy felt crampy all day before they went into labor, and that their stools were all loose and watery. We concur that it can be hard to tell the difference between diarrhea cramps and early labor contractions. In fact, as we girlfriends think back on it, we believe that they were probably the same thing. For this reason, it is wise to pay particular attention to a funky tummy in your third trimester. Just as you feel the need to clean everything before your baby is born, your intestines also seem to have a nesting instinct. Often, shortly before or during the early stages of labor, you may find your bowels wanting to clean out anything you may have eaten in the last 24 hours. If it happens to you, be grateful, because this evacuation means you are off and running, and because there will be less poo-poo on the delivery table when you push. Until recently, it was traditional hospital procedure to give all delivering women enemas. Since then, the prevailing wisdom has been that a little poop never killed anyone. Passing the mucus plug. The mucus plug is exactly what it sounds like. A kind of bloody, snotty thing that corks up your cervix so that no nasty germs get through to your uterus while the baby is in there growing. The thinning of the cervix and the beginning of its dilation can leave the plug no longer big enough to fill the hole, and out it comes. I will never forget my girlfriend Lorraine screaming for me from the bathroom when she was very, very pregnant. "Look in there," she cried, pointing into the toilet and staring into the bowl, bug-eyed. "What is that?" I, who had not yet had children myself and had never seen anything so disgusting floating in a bowl, just stood there dumbly and held tight to her arm, because I was certain at least one of us would faint. There are two important things to know about passing your mucus plug. First, labor will soon begin, but not necessarily immediately. Many girlfriends have passed their plugs and not gone into labor for a couple more days. And second, this is only a good thing. It doesn't hurt, and since it usually happens while you're sitting on the toilet, it doesn't even make a mess. Oh, yes, one last thing. Not everyone passes her mucus plug before active labor and delivery. I have never seen my mucus plugs, and believe me, I have peered into many a toilet bowl hoping to find one. Your water breaks. Everyone has heard this expression with regard to pregnancy, but few of us know what to expect or recognize it when it happens to us. Of course, water doesn't really break, but the membrane that has been filled with water for your little baby to float around in for the last 40 weeks does. This is the result of a uterine contraction or the baby's head pushing against it and popping it. Sometimes it pops like a water balloon, with a gush of water soaking you, your clothes, and wherever you have been lying or standing. Other times the bag just springs a leak and you feel a constant trickle of water between your legs. Either way, the universal sensation is, "I'm peeing, and I can't stop." My girlfriend Jillian says that when it happened to her, she rushed to the toilet. She peed so much that she reached behind her and flushed the toilet halfway through, because she was really worried she would fill the bowl and it would overflow onto the bathroom floor. And this is a mother of four, so you know that this birthing business is just full of surprises. What contributes to the sensation that the water supply is unending is that it is indeed unending. Your body replenishes the water, placental fluid, at an astonishing rate, so that the baby doesn't get dry or pruny, or more important, so that infection doesn't set in, so you can really dribble away for hours. Since about half of all expectant mothers will have their water break at home, it is a good idea to prepare for its happening to you. One particularly good idea is to put a mattress protector or a plastic sheet on your bed. Your water tends to break in bed and really gush because the baby is relaxing on your spine or side when you sleep. Then when you stand up, the flow will stop or slow down a lot because the baby's head will go back down on your cervix and act like a drain plug. The other suggestion I would make is to always wear a sanitary napkin during your last few weeks. One napkin, even a super duper maxi, definitely won't be enough to soak up all the water, but it will give you running time to get out of the checkup line at the grocery store and into a bathroom. Two important things you should know about your water breaking are, 1, it does not hurt at all. 2, you must call your doctor and get ready to go to the hospital, because this event will only end with a baby coming out. You can go for a few days without your plug, but if you are near or past your due date, your doctor will probably not want you to walk around with your water draining out for more than a few hours. Dilation and effacement. By the time you've delivered your baby, you will toss around these two words with great casualness. But for now, let me explain what they mean. Dilation, which we girlfriends agree is the most important of the two, refers to the stretching open of the cervix, the short tunnel that connects your uterus to your vagina. Effacement describes the shortening of that tunnel in preparation for birth. By the time you're ready to push, the tunnel, that is the cervix, is so short that it's not so much a tunnel anymore as it is a sort of membrane between the uterus and the vagina. And in dilation, this membrane is stretched wide enough for a baby's head to come out. Dilation is measured on a scale of 1 to 10. If you are 1 to 2 centimeters open or dilated, that baby isn't going anywhere. By the time your cervix is open 10 centimeters wide, which theoretically means the doctor can stick all 10 of his or her fingertips inside the opening, it's bombs away. Unless you're a contortionist, you cannot determine for yourself if you are dilating or effacing. These are things your doctor will report to you during your last few office visits. For first-time mothers, there is a tremendous satisfaction in calling your friends and family to announce that your doctor has told you that you are 2 centimeters dilated and 25% effaced. With that kind of news, labor is certain to be right around the corner, right? Well, not necessarily. Millions of pregnant women are on the streets right this very minute, walking around 2 and 3 centimeters dilated, and their babies still might not come for another week or two, or even 3. Sorry. Other very pregnant women forlornly leave their doctor's office after being told that their cervix is closed up as tight as a clam, only to go into active labor that same night. So my advice is this. If you are effacing and dilating, go ahead and get excited, because the least it can do is relieve your boredom. And if you are not changing at all in there, do not worry one little bit, because it doesn't mean a thing. By my 4th pregnancy, I walked around for weeks so dilated that my vagina made little squeaky noises with every step, and it felt as if the baby's head were between my thighs. But did the baby come early? Not by 1 second. Contractions. The confusing thing about contractions is that they come in all forms and intensities. I would estimate that 99% of us go into labor having absolutely no idea what to expect. And when it begins, we all wonder, is this really it? The girlfriend's rule of thumb is this. If you think you might be in labor, stay calm. Rarely does a first baby slip out 10 minutes after the first contraction, so there would probably be no need to call 911 at this point. It is important, however, that you don't be a labor martyr either. If you feel unusual in any way, pick up the phone and call your doctor, even if you just saw him or her 2 hours ago. Believe me when I tell you that doctors expect you to rely on them to tell you if you are in labor or not. Call them. It makes them feel needed. The myth of false labor. This is probably a good time to talk about false labor. The most reassuring thing I can tell you about false labor is that it is a myth. That's right. Hogwash. It's just one more thing to make you feel that you are ignorant and out of control when you are pregnant. All contractions are contractions, and all contractions are preparation for birth. Some just occur closer to the time of birth than others. Therefore, you are not a moron if you feel contractions, go to the hospital, and then get sent home. It happens all the time. It simply means that these contractions you are feeling are not noticeably dilating and effacing your cervix, and you might have a few more hours or days before things start opening up in there. My girlfriend Sandra had me drive her to the doctor when her second baby was due. We really flew down the freeway because she was having contractions, and since she had already had one baby, she knew what labor felt like. Half an hour later, we were sent home empty-handed. No open sesame. A week later, she felt contractions again, but this time they were stronger and more regular, so she skipped the doctor's office and met him directly at the hospital. Wouldn't you know it? Still no open sesame. But by this time, Sandra had had enough of this torture, and she refused to leave the hospital. She informed her doctor with a hint of hysteria in her voice that she would not go home until she had a new baby to take with her. In fact, your uterus has been contracting ever since your egg got fertilized, but you probably really didn't start noticing it until the middle or end of your pregnancy. The contractions that do not noticeably open your cervix are called Braxton Hicks contractions. They are designed by God to get you in the mood for labor. Toward the end of your pregnancy, your uterus will frequently contract with increasing intensity. Sometimes your belly gets so hard and rigid that you could bounce a dime off it. Most pregnancy books say that Braxton Hicks contractions do not hurt. And compared to productive contractions, this may be true. But my girlfriends who had a lot of them say that they were by no means painless. While they may not feel like a knife stabbing you in the tummy, they can be serious enough to take your breath away and make you feel the need to sit down or lean against something. And early labor can feel exactly the same way. So you can see why it's easy to get confused. Some women feel mild cramping contractions for a full day or two before their contractions get compelling enough for them to go to the hospital. My girlfriends Janice and Tracy both felt kind of punk, as though they were getting the flu or their period. Remember those? When they were in early stages of labor. They called their doctors to check in, then casually kept an eye on the clock to see if their moments of crampiness had any regularity or pattern. In the meantime, they called their families and hung around the house. My girlfriend Patty had these mild contractions at first, too, but she had no intention of waiting all day in her house for something to happen. She and her husband went to a matinee movie, then to the hospital. My girlfriend Amy never had time to buy a box of popcorn, let alone see an entire movie, because her labor always came out of the clear blue sky and with the intensity of a thunderstorm. With the first contraction, she knew it was time to go to the hospital. And by the time she got there, she was already feeling the urge to push. Her description of trying to take off her cowboy boots in a tiny hospital bathroom while in hard labor is really funny. Cowboy boots are problematic even under the best circumstances. A quick, efficient labor can be good and bad. It is good if you dread a long, drawn-out, tiring labor, but it is bad if you've had your heart set on an epidural because there won't really be time for one. If you are feeling the flu-like period-like symptoms, and your baby is due, of course, and you would like to try to move things along a bit, walking could be a good idea. If you don't feel like walking, however, sleep is equally valuable, and a little nap might be the perfect thing. Some women will have irregular and relatively manageable contractions for more than a day. The pains are not strong enough to make them rush to the hospital, but they are too strong for them to get any sleep. If this happens to you for more than 24 hours, your doctor might prescribe a sedative or sleep medication so that you can get some rest before the final rounds of labor begin. You might want to eat something light because once you get to the hospital, it's ice chips and cotton swabs that taste like lemon until you get that baby out. Chances are, you're so excited and nervous that food is the last thing on your mind, but a little soup or a milkshake couldn't hurt. Scheduled C-section. One other persuasive indication that your baby is coming soon is a scheduled C-section. With a scheduled C-section, you and your doctor have agreed to a time at which you will enter the hospital in a fairly calm and leisurely fashion, and he or she will extract your baby through a small slit at the top of your pubic hair. There are a lot of reasons to schedule a cesarean section, including medical conditions such as placenta previa, don't ask, breech babies, or twins or triplets. Other women elect to have a cesarean because they want to maintain the vaginal tone of a teenager, and their doctors find medical explanations that will suit their insurance companies. And then there are those women who temperamentally just can't take the uncertainty that waiting for labor to begin entails. If they are lucky, their doctors, too, will help them contour their insurance policies to cover this planned delivery. Of course, I cannot have a clear conscience unless I remind you that it is actually better for the baby to be born vaginally, for many reasons. The squeezing helps force the fluid out of their lungs. You will need less anesthesia, if you consider this a good thing, and your recovery will be quicker. Still, C-sections are safe for mother and child, and the recovery time is surprisingly short. Yes, I read the papers, and I am aware of the outrage in some quarters about the number of unnecessary C-sections that are performed in the United States. Am I resentful or indignant? Not particularly. The temptation will be extraordinary for you to feel that you would rather have your fingernails pulled out by their roots than succumb to a C-section. You will be convinced that the big emotional payoff for pregnancy lies in the physical challenge of laboring and delivering the baby vaginally. Gingerly, I suggest that you do not set these expectations for yourself. A significant number of women who have their hearts set on vaginal births will end up having C-sections, and there is absolutely no reason for this to be a source of disappointment. As someone who has had babies both ways, I must admit that I don't really have a preference for one over the other. Having a healthy baby was all I really wanted, and I didn't care how I got it. However, by the fourth child, I was begging my doctor for a C-section in the fear that if I had any more big noggins come through my vagina, my husband would be able to yodel and hear his echo down there. My doctor then gave me the disappointing news that it is the first vaginal birth that does most of the stretching, so I grudgingly agreed to let yet another one come down the pike and made him promise to stitch me up very, very well afterward. So now that you are in labor, what should you do? All of the popular books on pregnancy will tell you not to rush off to the hospital too early because they will hook you up to an IV and not give you anything to eat or drink. It is also suggested in these books that once you get to the hospital, you will be forced to lie down. This is considered a bad thing because lying down is one of the least productive postures for a woman in labor. I would just like to say that I was never asked to lie down when I was in labor. At least not until I went for the epidural. And then it was a tremendous relief to lie down. In fact, after the baby was born, a nurse was at my bedside within hours telling me I had to get up and walk around. But I digress. If you and your doctor agree that you are fine and comfortable laboring at home for the first few hours, that is wonderful. I, however, love maternity wards. I love all the new mothers, the pictures of babies on the walls, the nursery full of babies, the abundance of trained medical professionals. I cannot think of a place where I would rather be in labor, no matter how many hours lie ahead of me. You have a choice. You can walk around your own house to help you labor along, or you can walk around the hospital. At least at the hospital, you won't feel compelled to make all the beds and unload the dishwasher while you walk, and you won't have to rush to get there later. Top 10 Ways to Deliver Babies. 10. In a Scientology silent birthing room with Tom Cruise as the birth coach. 9. When you're not in a car, or on an airplane, or at a sporting event that serves beer on tap. 8. In a hospital room where your cell phone works. 7. On an empty stomach. Sure, you'll get hungry, but since the proper pushing technique is like pooping, it could cut down on the mess, even though no one really cares except you. 6. With your lipstick and a small mirror in your partner's pocket. 5. With clean hair, no roots, and a fresh pedicure. 4. With someone at your house, cleaning and cooking for your return. 3. With Dr. McDreamy as your obstetrician. 2. Sipping on an epidural cocktail and watching Oprah. 1. Via FedEx. Chapter 16. Going to the Hospital. All right, girlfriend, here we go. You and your doctor have reason to believe that your baby is on its way, and it's time to go to the hospital, or whatever other professional birthing center filled with competent and caring medical people you have selected. I swear, this time is filled with excitement, fear, and anticipation that no astronaut getting ready to enter a space capsule has ever felt more anxious. It isn't liftoff yet, but from now on, everything leads to this ultimate conclusion. This is what you have been building up to and preparing for 9-10 months, but you still don't really know what to expect, even if you've already had kids. A general suggestion for women about to have babies is to try to get a shower in before liftoff, because it will be quite a while before the opportunity will arise again. If you are not laboring so hard that you risk giving birth on your shower towels, hop in for a quick shampoo and underarm shave before leaving for the hospital. The two rules in this area are, 1. Do not take a shower if you are alone in the house, because you might decide mid-suds that it wasn't such a good idea, after all, and you might need someone to help you out. 2. Do not take a bath if you have any reason to think your water is broken, because you may introduce bacteria into your uterus. Besides, if you think getting out of the shower while experiencing contractions is a challenge, wait until you try hoisting yourself out of a tub. The drive. I know that you have never even considered this, but it will make me feel better if I just say it. Do not try to drive yourself to the hospital. Even if you think the contractions are bearable and that you are perfectly fine to drive, don't get behind the wheel, because conditions in labor have been known to change quickly. Also, women in labor are rather like people who have been drinking. They think that they are acting normally and are in control, but they should not be allowed behind the steering wheel of a car under any circumstances. If your mate isn't home, call a girlfriend, a neighbor, a cab, or 911. One revelation that almost all my girlfriends had was that the car ride to the hospital is a bigger deal than they had imagined it would be. In their meticulous planning and anticipation, they had pictured what they would do at home and what they would do at the hospital, but the car ride in between had been an inconsequential detail. Then, when they were actually in labor and in the car, they realized that this ride might be a challenge in itself. It can be as uncomfortable as a ride in a wagon with square wooden wheels. First of all, sitting upright with a seatbelt around you is not the most comfortable position in which to labor. If your front passenger seat reclines, put it back as far as it will go. If it doesn't, ride in the back seat where you can sprawl. Do try to wear your seatbelt, even if you are reclining or leaning in the back. Your driver will be particularly nervous and prone to slamming on the brakes unexpectedly, so being strapped to your seat will help you cope. Besides, you haven't come through the last 9-10 months in pure and perfect health, only to get injured in the car ride to deliver the baby. Like the princess with the pea under her mattress, you will feel every pothole and piece of gravel in the road during this ride. You will also be feeling a tad irritable, so you will probably curse the Department of Public Works the whole way, when you are not silently cursing your darling husband for turning so sharply, stopping so abruptly, and getting you pregnant in the first place. One good way to counter this is to bring your bed pillows from home, as many as you can carry. You will not only love their familiar comfort during the car ride, but you will continue to appreciate them in your hospital bed, where they traditionally top the bed with some wafer-shaped thing that they have slipped into a pillowcase. Put one pillow under your head and one between your legs, and try to rest on your side in the car. Once again, the left side is the politically correct one, but at a time like this, embrace any side that works for you. Try turning on the radio. Its familiar music or mundane chatter might be reassuring and might distract you from whatever discomfort you may be feeling. It will also help relieve you of the obligation of keeping up a conversation with your husband, who will be as nervous as you are. An old doctor's rule of thumb is that if you are expecting a productive contraction, you will be unable to speak during it, or at most, only be able to make strained, high-pitched noises. As soon as the contraction passes, you will return to your garrulous or complaining self. If you are in active labor during the car ride, your conversation will be punctuated by contractions. If the radio is irritating you, ask your husband to turn it off, even if it's your husband's favorite song. Be creative in your endeavors to be comfortable. Try silence. Try asking your husband to tell you a story or a joke. Try singing 100 bottles of beer on the wall. Heck, you could even try out those Lamaze skills and see if you think they're going to get you through this ordeal. Why waste valuable time at the hospital when you could be getting your epidural? Bring a bottle of water. Room temperature is best, because you will be less inclined to get stomach cramps from it to sip along the way. Once you are checked into the hospital, you won't be given another taste of that glorious liquid until the baby is on its way to the nursery to be measured and weighed. Even then, it will be a challenge to flag down a nurse or orderly to get you something to drink, because the doctor and nurses seem to magically disappear along with the baby. Don't drink too much or too fast, however, because you might get nauseous, and the only thing worse than having contractions in a moving car is vomiting at the same time. Checking into the hospital. Please don't hold me to the details because every hospital has its own routines and policies. But what follows is a general description of what happens once you get to the hospital. Under ideal circumstances, you have pre-registered and handled all your paperwork and insurance stuff weeks ago. Also ideally, labor is progressing at a manageable pace, and you have had time to call your doctor and he has told the hospital you are coming. Under these conditions, you will go to whatever admissions desk handle maternity patients. A bit of information you will have learned beforehand. Within seconds, you will find yourself seated in a wheelchair, whether you want one or not. Don't start arguing or making a scene about the wheelchair, because it's required by the hospital's insurance policy. Besides, if you start out complaining and arguing, you may piss off someone upon whose mercy you may later have to rely. Shut up, sit back, and enjoy the ride. If you have not been pre-admitted to the hospital, you may have to check in via the emergency room. Don't worry. They move visibly pregnant women right to the head of the line here, no matter how many broken legs are ahead of you. After a quick check-in, you might be taken to an area called triage. This is usually a larger room with several nurses and several beds, divided by curtains if you are lucky. In triage, you are examined and put on a monitor to see if you are having productive contractions. If you are, then your doctor is called and you are sent to a labor room. If you are not, you will be told to get dressed and go home. If this happens to you, please do not be too discouraged and don't be in the least bit embarrassed. I can describe triage to you because I have been there a couple of times myself and have been sent home, even though I had already given birth to 2 children, and you might have thought I would have known better. My husband hates triage and he wants me to warn you about it. Every time we have been there, some woman has been in the bed next to me moaning and crying in labor, basically scaring him to death. If this happens to you, just mind your own business and repeat to yourself, I am just fine. The woman next to me is no indication of how my own labor will go. Trust me, these words are true, and there is no sense in letting someone else's fear contaminate you. You will be just fine. And by the way, so will she. The trend in customer-pleasing hospitals is to make the labor and delivery rooms more home-like and less surgical. Often, uncomplicated deliveries take place in the same room where you have labored. Do not take this new development for granted. In the not-too-distant past, right when you at least wanted to move, like when your contractions were coming one on top of the last, you were taken from a labor room to a bright and sterile surgical room to deliver, with stirrups and everything. I had my last 2 babies in rooms with televisions, telephones, a stereo, and even lights that could be dimmed. It was divine. Once you're admitted either to triage or to your labor room, you will be given a big plastic bag and directed to a bathroom to change into a hospital gown. The plastic bag is for you to put your own clothes and shoes in. Yes, you must take off everything, including bras, panties, and watches. You may, however, keep your socks on, and you will be grateful for this small comfort. At this time, you will meet someone who will become an important figure in your life, your labor and delivery nurse. This person, more than your doctor, more than your husband, and certainly more than any book on pregnancy, will help get you through this ordeal. Trust her advice. She has been through this birthing business hundreds of times and knows what she's talking about. If the angels are smiling on you, she will be a girlfriend by the time this ordeal is over. Mine, Estelle, is still my friend and our kids are in school together 16 years after our first delivery. On the slim chance that you discover immediately that you can't stand the nurse who has been assigned to you, beg your husband to see if you can trade her in for another model. Don't make it about her being mean or insensitive or